right, folks, welcome back to this American History program of History at Our House for the junior and senior high class. After our Columbus Day break, we are embarking on a new segment of our studies shortly here. So today we are going to, in effect, do a kind of a review and preview. And the review is going to be, in a sense, fairly straightforward, but I'm going to be introducing an exercise, which many of you have seen in some form or another in the past, but which now is going to become a regular segment of the classes. And I'm also going to be introducing, two exercises at this level, because at the junior and senior high level, you've got to do more than just remember some of the content from the past. In fact, you have to master it to a certain extent. So I'm going to be discussing what the standard it is that you're going to have to meet with regard to the previous content. And then I'm going to be showing you, giving you an overview of what's to come. Now, just wanted to, it occurs to me that I should just talk a little bit about the test, and in particular, some of you may be waiting for, anticipating the grading key. So yes, that will be posted along with today's lecture resources. So you'll see that on the Lecture 21 resources. You will see Test 1 Answer Key for the junior high level anyway. Now, if you have not taken the test yet, and there's no, I don't enforce that, you know, as far as a procedure within the course at the junior high level, I still do not enforce testing. In other words, I'm not gonna insist that you send it to me. But if you are not taking the tests, you definitely cannot proceed to the high school level. So tests are not, I mean, they are optional in a sense, but they are not optional in another sense, right? So in other words, if you intend to graduate in a sense to the high school level, you have to take the tests. And I will need to see them at the end of the year, especially if you consider yourself to be 9th grade or 8th or 9th grade, and you will be graduating, then I will ask to have them sent to me at the end of the year. So you have to kind of put yourself, you have to decide where you stand right now if you are not yet taking the tests. And if you aren't, you probably should have your parents contact me and have a discussion about that. Okay? Because at the junior high level, you are, in particular, you're in a training phase that's quite important with regard to your growth and your ability to handle what's to come at the high school level, whether it's in this course or elsewhere. And testing is going to be a part of your academic landscape no matter where you are. And in particular, if you intend to go on to college and you want to take this or that test, a placement test or an advanced placement test and all of those things, testing is there. So you do need to do testing as a part of your intellectual growth. So let me know if there's something you feel or your parents feel needs to be discussed with me on the front, on the testing front, then let me know. But I will be keeping track of your progress in a variety of ways, and one of them is going to be an exercise relating to some of the facts that I consider to be non-optional in terms of your knowledge and you as a person emerging from this course and what you're going to be able to say that you know. There are certain things that are non-optional, and I will insist upon testing those. In some ways, practically every single day that you are here for the remainder of the year. And there's an exercise where we're going to be doing that. And that exercise is called Facts Practice. And so I'm going to put this up on the screen here. And so you are, it's a one page exercise. This is the very first one that you're going to be doing. And, you'll see this entitled Facts Practice 1A. And I'll explain why. It's for your level. It's for American history. And it includes all of the anchor facts. One page. And you will notice that, you know, it's very similar to what you already had on the test. And this is stuff that we have been reviewing and reviewing and reviewing and so on. And there is a reason for that. There's absolutely a very important reason for that. It is that these are the building blocks of historical knowledge. If you do not know that these things happened, then, quite frankly, you don't know history. And you can't know it. I mean, if anybody were to tell me, oh yeah, I know history, and I gave them this sheet and I said, fill this in, and they couldn't fill it in, I would be able to prove in the span of that short moment that they don't know history. And I'd be able to show them where some of their crucial gaps are, because these are, there's a Latin expression, and there are a lot of Latin expressions in our modern culture. There's a Latin expression called sine qua non. Have you ever heard that? I'll type it out for you because it's kind of a cool one. Sine qua non. Anybody know what that means? From the dead silence, I take it no. So, that without which, in effect, is what this phrase means. So, that without which. Sine is without, but the word order in Latin is... the word order in Latin is different, but so sine means without, which not. So technically it means without which not. Without which not. But what it means is, if you that without which, if you do not know this, you don't know nothing. I'm sorry, that's pretty rude, and it's kind of ridiculous sounding to claim that, but. But when I say you don't know history, I mean that with a capital H. I mean not some little tidbit, some little isolated part of the story, some you know, dis or unintegrated part of it. I mean the story. I mean the whole thing. If you don't know these, you don't know history, period. So these are the sine qua non of history, the anchor facts. You cannot build an integrated body of historical knowledge without these. And I know that for certain. So that's why we're going to be practicing them. That's what this exercise is called. It's called Facts Practice. Very straightforward concept. You are going to be practicing the facts. And so what are you going to do? You're going to answer these questions in written form as quickly as you can, repeatedly, 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 until what? If you practice and practice and practice all the time, what's going to happen? Let me hear somebody else's voice today. What's going to happen? Real question. I just noticed that the sound of your hand raising has annoyingly returned. But Alexander, go ahead. What's going to happen?
You'll know them and you'll memorize them and they'll become reflexive.
Ooh, nice. Yes. Without the sass, it is, in essence, what's going to happen is they are going to become reflexive. Now let me just go and change the parameters for just 1 second here. Okay, right. Sorry about that. I have to toggle back off the display because the hand raising was making that annoying noise. So let me go back to sharing my desktop. So what's the value of having this information become reflexive? Well, the value of that lies in the technical word for that, by the way, to have it become reflexive in your consciousness, in effect, is that it's called automatization. Automatization. There's a good vocabulary word for you. Let me chant that one out to you as well. Automatization. This repeated exercise of memorizing and writing out as quickly as you can allows you to automatize the facts. Which means what? What does automatize mean? Anybody? Automatize means to render automatic. Just like Alexander was saying, right? Like that example that I was giving of something that's automatic or reflexive is when you go to the doctor's office and he bangs on your kneecap with a little plastic hammer, your leg shoots out. And if it doesn't, you got a problem. So it's automatic, right? It's a reflex. You see this, or in different cases, which I'm going to make different versions of this facts practice, as you will see, you have an automatic response. And another word for automatic here in this context would be effortless. In other words, you don't even have to think about it. It just comes out. Now, this is a deceptively simple thing. It's a deceptively simple thing because a lot of people and your parents, I guarantee you, if you go back to them and you say, Mr. Powell's going to make us memorize stuff. If you go back and you tell your parents that, they're going to probably get upset or they're going to get worried. What's going on? History memorization is tedious and it really has a really negative connotation for most grown-ups. It certainly did for me when I was a young adult. The idea of memorizing stuff for the test was obviously corrupt. And you have had to do this, and you will have to do this in your life, sadly, because of the state of education. You will have to memorize a lot of stuff and regurgitate it onto a page for somebody else to jump through the hoops in order to get this or that credential or this or that sanction from somebody in order to move on in your life. I'm sorry to say that's going to happen to you. And it's not, you're not going to like it. And you might get pretty cynical about it. You might feel like, oh, grown-ups really don't know what they're doing. And you might get kind of jaded about all that. I don't blame you. It's hard not to. I certainly did, and it took me a long time to get over it in my own process of learning. I hated history when I was a kid because most of it was memorizing useless facts and then regurgitating them onto a page and then immediately forgetting them after the test. Right? That is usually how people experience testing. In modern education, you study. It's called studying for the test. And so what you do is you get an A plus because you can regurgitate all the material onto a piece of paper. It means nothing because you're going to forget all of it. If you were asked any of the questions again 1 year from the test, you would not know any of the answers. But you do it and you get an A plus, and then you get a degree, and then you get a job, and then yada yada yada. So that's how most people think of this this regurgitative exercise of memorizing and reproducing information thoughtlessly or parroting the information. It's very sad. And a lot of people, if you tell them, oh yeah, Mr. Powell's making me memorize different things in history, that's the thought that they're going to have. They won't be able to have a different notion of memorization. Now, in this course, however, memorization is not based on that approach to education. Memorization of certain facts, only a select set of facts, is going to be essential to becoming a proper thinker, an effective, efficient thinker of history, to become historically minded. To be a historically minded person, which means to be able to summon historical knowledge as a part of your thinking, requires that there actually be some knowledge stored in your brain, and that you be able to recall it effortlessly and to summon it as a part of your thinking. And then what happens is, if those facts are effortless, then your brain doesn't have to work on them. You don't have to feel all burdened by going and Googling another fact and Googling, and you're trying to have an interesting thought, but you don't know any facts, so you Google them. And then you Google another thing, and you don't know anything. You just, whatever happens to show up on the screen, you kind of pretend to yourself that you know. If you do that, then you can't actually have any interesting thoughts about history. Because what happens is your mind becomes burdened by juggling the facts. And you don't have any spare room in the way that your brain is working to actually connect them and do anything interesting with them. So if you want to have an interesting thought about the state of modern American culture and the direction that it's taking and the significance of the next election and so on and so forth, you can't have those thoughts. They're off limits to you if you don't have facts that just are available to your thinking. Simply available, automatized and effortless, in order for you to fuel your thinking. Facts that are there for your mental processes to use, and then you make an effort and you think. You don't have any facts to work with? Quite frankly, thinking is impossible to you. So, that's what this exercise is. It's giving you guys some facts so that you can think. And it's very, very important that you practice them so that it becomes absolutely automatized, that you are able to summon this information. And then you'll see, we will see in very specific details as the course proceeds, how that works. I'll even give you a few examples of it today. We'll see whether or not you can summon the facts. And I'll show you what it's like to kind of start having this as a base that you can build on and grow and become aware of the world around you in a new way. So it's exciting when you pull it off. It's exciting when you pull it off. So what you're going to do here is quite simply you're going to fill it in. And some of you have already noticed that the so what question is not featured here. Can anybody guess why not? It's not because there's no room. There was room on this page. You can see that I erased the so what question. Can anybody guess why it's not on here? After all this long spiel about memorization and all that kind of stuff, why is it not on here, the so what question? Well, the answer is, or let me help you and see if you can pick this up and run with it. This is a facts practice. Not a what? What does, what's the so what question? That's a different question. What is that? Is that a basic fact? So what? It's not one of those five W's, right? It's not one of those who, what, when, where, how, or four, whatever, the W's and the H and all that. It's not. It's so Alexander's kind of got the idea here in his chat. He says it's not a meaning practice. I would put that a little differently. I would say it's not a thought practice. The so what question is thinking. It's an example of thinking, which you cannot do without the facts. So let's do question one here. Who, what, where, and when. Okay, that's the reflexive part. Okay, somebody answer me, please. Declan, you should know this. Who, what, where, and when?
The first one, right?
Yes.
Who is Menes Narmer unifies Egypt?
Okay, when? Not quite coming out reflexively. I think if you had really studied for the test, you probably would. Alexander, when?
Circa 3000 BC.
Okay. All right. So, Menes Narmer unifies Egypt circa 3000 BC. That's just a fact. Who cares? Okay, now, the so what question is designed to help you think. It's designed to get you to try to engage with that fact and seek out a connection. Thinking involves connections. It says, I'm going to take this, I'm going to put it side by side with something else, and I'm going to think. So the so what question is, here's a fact, here's me in my world right now. What's the connection? That's thinking. So what is the connection? What's the answer to the so what, which you were supposed to have down on your test? What is the so what? Okay, what's the so what?
So what is, from an hour, this is what the world was like for 5,000 years, this monarchy bashing people's heads in, conquering other people, and then having one monarch. That's what the world was like for 5,000 years, until the United States.
Until the U.S., right. So you're living in an aberration. Do you understand that? You're not living in a normal place. This is not normal what you have. For 5,000 years, people have not had this. Never mind prehistory. You know full well that they didn't have it before 3,000 B.C. either. There weren't any founding fathers living in caves, fighting saber-toothed tigers. So, no, human beings have never had this. This is new. This is special. You are not living in a normal time. That's a thought. You see that? That's meaning. Menes Narmer unifies Egypt, circa 3000 BC. That's a robotic fact. But in order to have, but do you see the connection here? See what I'm trying to point out is, how can you have the thought, the world around me is not normal? How can you have that thought without knowing what has been normal for 5,000 years of recorded history? That thought is off limits to you if you don't know the answers to these fact questions. I mean, this is only the beginning of that thought. But it's the minimum, absolutely the bare minimum. And in a sense, it's still very new to you, and it's still kind of just you getting a chance to start having this thought. But if you've studied Chinese history, which is about 4,000 years of continuous history, guess what? 1 billion people. And what have they ever had? Do they have freedom? No. 4,000 years of 1 billion people. Go look at India. 4,000 years of 1 billion people. Do any of them have freedom? No. Go look at the Middle East. Anybody over there have freedom? No. Go look at Africa. Go look at America before Columbus. Anybody there have any freedom? No. Whoa, this freedom thing is new. It's where does it come from? How do we get it? How do we keep it? If we don't want to go back to the normal stuff, which is man as normer, how do we keep the freedom part? All right, so the so what is not to be practiced and parroted. Right? I've been encouraging you to think about the so what, and to a certain extent, I've been having you kind of memorize it. But quite frankly, you can't memorize that. That would be fake. And you have to be honest with yourself here. You're old enough, and you are at a stage in your life where you've got to start having these thoughts. You cannot fake these things anymore. You can't just go through the motions. I mean, if you do, you're condemning yourself to a certain kind of life. If you're not willing to think, you're condemning yourself to being a drone in society, basically. Somebody that does what they're told. To be a thinker, an independent person in this world, you gotta have your own mind turned on. You gotta be able to engage with the world on your own. It's not easy. It's not easy. And a lot of people abdicate that personal responsibility in various ways. And they suffer for it. Guarantee you. So the so what, I'm not giving you that on a facts practice. That would be a disservice to you, because you've got to have these thoughts. You've got to try to have these thoughts. And if you're not having them, you got to ask questions and try to see if you can get that part of your brain turned on. Because there's nobody else that can do it. That's what's called free will. There's only one person that has the ability to turn on your brain. It doesn't matter how excited I get. It doesn't matter how I raise my voice and how quickly I can speak. Doesn't matter how much I tell you I love history. Doesn't matter. There's only one person that has the free will for you to engage your mind on those thoughts, and that's you. So I put this in front of you. I'm here. We can talk about any so what you want. But I'm not going to tell you, I'm not going to have you parrot that, right? I'm not going to have you pretend that you know it by memorizing it. So the so what is not on here. It's up to you. I'll keep asking you the questions. Keen gave a pretty darn good answer there for number one. And you're the one who has to monitor for yourself whether or not this stuff is good for you or not. And if it's not, it's also your responsibility to do something about it. And say, Mr. Powell, yeah, I wish it weren't the case, but I tell you what, I'm still struggling with number four. I'm not entirely clear on why that's something that has to be part of the foundation of my thinking about the world. Tell me more about that. Give me another angle on that. Help me, Mr. Powell, and I'll do it. Guaranteed. We'll recruit the whole class, and everybody will be working on it. And everybody will benefit. If you are aggressive about it. All right. So, anyway, I got to get on to the preview part, because I'm excited about that, and I want to get you guys excited. But basically, I'm going to be posting this sheet to the class webpage. And what we're going to do is, you are going to practice it. And, in other words, print it out. And fill it out. Make sure that you can fill everything out. And tomorrow we'll do, somebody hopefully will remind me in case I forget, but tomorrow I want to do this as a group, once again, as quickly as possible. We're running out of time for today, so I want to put it off till tomorrow. But we'll do a review so that on Monday you know what's expected. And basically what we're going to do on Monday is, before class, we'll do a fags practice, and it'll be a race. It'll be a race. You know, your assignment to prepare for class will be that you print out a copy of this, and you are poised with a pencil over the page, and Mr. Powell will say, on your mark, get set, go, and you'll go, and I'll time you. And that's it. You'll race. And the goal will not be, of course, to beat everybody else, although that is tempting for some people to consider that that's the meaning of the race. The goal of the race will be to beat yourself. The goal of the race will be to improve you and get faster and faster and faster so that your fact awareness is automatized. And then you'll have access to these facts effortlessly, and you'll be able to start answering some interesting questions and having some interesting thoughts on your own. Alrighty. Questions or comments? Okay. Well, what is to come? The American History Program is divided up into six parts with six tests, right? And we've completed part one. And so we're moving on to part two. And so here it is, right? In part one, we capped off our studies in part one. We did the anchor facts, and then we did the European world of Christopher Columbus. That's the old world. Now, in part two, we're going to talk about the shaping of the new one. The new world, I mean, that's one of the expressions that people used and still use to this day to describe America, right? They say, Christopher Columbus discovered the new world. Well, that's one way of looking at it, and kind of geographically. People call Europe the old world, and they call America the new world. But in a sense also, in terms of time, European culture, the old world is the European culture of 1492. And the new world is going to be a different culture. It's going to be a globalized culture. It's going to be an American-centered culture. It's going to be a high technology and science culture. It's going to be very, very different. That's the new society, the new civilization that we live in. And so in order to understand how that comes about, starting from the starting point is 1492, in order to understand how this new world that we live in comes about, we've got three key threads that we're going to follow through on. So I'm going to give you a little preview of what that looks like. The first key thread that we're going to talk about is called the Age of Discovery. And that involves Columbus and all of the explorers who are going to discover the full extents of all of the continents and the oceans and their relationships to each other. Really, for the first time ever, figure out what this world is that we live on, because basically human beings were ignorant of it all the way up until this point, shockingly, but they were. And then as a part of that, we're going to see that this age of discovery is a feature of a broader phenomenon, an amazing transformation that's known as the Renaissance. Now, I think some people here already recognize that word. What does the word Renaissance mean? It's a French word, but what's the English translation for it? Keen?
Rebirth.
Rebirth. Okay. So that is rebirth. What is going to be the interesting point about that? I'll give you a little preview today. And you already have some awareness of it, by the way, thanks to your anchor facts. And then the third theme that we're going to have to follow through on here is the Reformation and religious wars. So let me take you on an overview, an overflight of this series of of things that we're going to be studying here. So let me go here. I got some really cool pictures to give you. Oh, that's not, I didn't want to start there. I wanted to start here. And I didn't quite set this one up quite the way that I wanted. But anyway, so our age of discovery, right, includes Christopher Columbus, romantically depicted here by an artist as he arrives in the Americas and reveals to Europeans that there's this new land over here that they didn't really understand quite rightly. But Christopher Columbus sails for Spain. And we don't all speak Spanish, right? So we are going to talk about the fact that the Age of Discovery was very much a reflection of what we know about European society, which is that, yes, there is a Spain, but what else? What else do we know? It's not just like this thing, this big behemoth called Europe. This one consistent single culture is moving around in the world and shaping it, right? Christopher Columbus sails for Spain. What are the other national groups and peoples that we're going to have to account for here in our story? Alexander?
England and France and Portugal mostly.
At the very least, right, exactly. And in particular, in relation to us, what do we need to know? Which one of those is going to be our highest priority? Right? If we're going to honor the fact that we live in a certain world, which one of those matters the most, Juliet?
England.
Yeah, absolutely. England, right? So here we have Giovanni Caboto, another Italian navigator, just like Columbus. But he's not going to sail for Spain. 4 years after Columbus, he's going to sail for England. He's Italian. And the English, they can't pronounce his name, so they call him John Cabot. But he's going to sail for England. And he's going to reach a place that he's going to call Newfoundland. And there's a province in Canada to this day called Newfoundland. So the English are going to be coming. And the French are going to be coming. There's a painting of the mouth of the Mississippi River, Louisiana, right? Named after King Louis XIV of France. So these explorers from different countries are going to be engaging in this age of discovery. And Keane says, don't forget about the Dutch. Unfortunately, they're mostly forgettable. So we're not going to spend a lot of time talking about the Dutch, even though you might object to that. It's not that important present-centrically to talk about the Dutch because there is no significant Dutch presence in the New World, even though they were important actors. And I agree with you that I like their culture as well. But anyway, one interesting thing about the Age of Discovery is that Europeans, when they looked at America, for the most part, they were kind of upset that it was there. Because they weren't trying to get there, right? When Columbus discovers America, and some people like to make fun, and they say, oh, he didn't even know it was there. Like that somehow is a significant fact. Of course he didn't know it was there. He had to discover it. So what did he think was there? What were Europeans actually trying to get to when Columbus proposed that they sail west? Alexander?
China and India and the rest of Asia.
Yeah, right. China and India and the rest of Asia. And so when Columbus arrived in the Bahamas, he thought he was in an archipelago, which is a group of islands, next to Japan, which he called Cipango. We'll look at that on a map. And he thought that he was getting pretty close because he had a general idea of what things would look like over there. So he thought, yeah, I must be getting close to Japan. And no, it turns out not. And the Europeans decided, oh, this big continent's mostly in the way. Yeah, some of the Spanish and the Portuguese, they did a bunch of stuff. And not really directly related to America, but we'll look at a little bit of that. For the most part, the Europeans were looking at America and thinking, we got to get around this thing. And so here's a kind of a good, I like this painting. It shows us one of the big problems that they had was, you can't get around America. You can, but it sure is hard, right? If you want to go down around the bottom, like Ferdinand Magellan had to, that's a heck of a long voyage, very difficult to do. And here we have a painting of Europeans trying to get around the top. So, but you can't do that because of the ice. So, man, what a mess it was, the search for northern passages and so on. So we'll talk about this age of discovery and all the things they're trying to do. Until at a certain point, a guy named Richard Hakluyt says, wait a minute, this America place that we found, it might actually be useful for something else. Maybe we should go live there. And off begins the story. And here's Queen Elizabeth giving to Sir Walter Raleigh a charter to go and plant a colony in America, and off we go. We start to have Englishmen coming and trying to seriously get to America and do something. All right, so it's a little bit of a weird painting. The three dimensionality is a little bit doesn't quite succeed. Anyway. So this is the age of discovery part that we're going to be talking about. Beyond that, we're also going to be talking about another series of events having to do with... Wait a minute. That's not the one I wanted. Let's go back to the other one. Sorry, I went too fast. We're also going to be talking about the fact that the age of discovery was a part of something broader called the Renaissance. And some of you have studied that and are familiar with that. But we're going to talk about this transformation in world culture brought about by the Renaissance, which America, in a sense, 1776, is kind of a part of the Renaissance in a certain sense. It took a long time for freedom to get a rebirth. But you guys know that it is a rebirth. Where's our original birth? It's twins. Where's the original birth of freedom? Okay, now we're having a thought. Can you summon your facts? Where's our original birth, Piper?
I don't know.
Well, look on this page and find it. So Menes Narmer, is he the freedom fighter?
No.
No, yes. He's a ruler. All right, who's going to finally say, no more rulers? Let's start having a society where people are equal and their rights are protected. Who's going to say that? Athens and Rome. Okay, we're going to have the birth of democracy and the birth of the concept of a republic. So this is the birth right here. It's twins. And then this is the rebirth. Right? Because what do we have in between? What do we have in between? When we have this thing, what are we talking about? Are we talking about a republic, Alexander?
We're talking about rulers again.
We're talking about rulers again! And what about these guys? These European barbarians? Are they smart enough to have a democracy or a republic? Give me a break. They broke everything. They ruined everything. They're the ones responsible for this. So no, we're not going to have that until that we can have a renaissance. It managed to get on our timeline, didn't it? Till we can have this ancient wonder reborn, and we can get to this. Yeah, so we're going to see that the Renaissance is an amazing phenomenon. It's going to have, it's going to create a very strange thing, which is the world that we live in. Does the world that we live in make any sense to you? It's a weird place. It really is when you think about it. It is a very weird place because on the one hand, right, we have, let me go back to this one. On the one hand, we still have religion. And we have people, most people still have this idea of the supernatural and of the world kind of, this is a really important value. And it definitely shapes the way that people live and act. And then on the other hand, human beings fly through the sky in double-decker superplanes, thousands of times faster than birds, and they sleep while they're doing it. Are you kidding me? I mean, think about that. Right? I mean, this is first class on ye old Airbus, but this double, isn't this thing amazing? It's a double-decker superplane that travels at hundreds of miles per hour through the air, and people are on their way from Hong Kong to London, from Singapore to New York, from L.A. to Moscow, and what do they do while they're doing that? They're sleeping. I mean, just, you know, ponder that for a second. That's crazy. That's amazing. Human beings fly through the air at hundreds of miles an hour, and they sleep while they're doing it. And then they arrive on the other side, and they're just fine. They wake up, and they go transact business, and they go and they visit museums, and then they go back home. So what a strange world we live in. I mean, this is, if you, right, I mean, in a sense, even when the Spanish arrived in the Americas, what did those primitive people think of them and their capacity to fire a weapon from a distance and kill somebody from 50 meters away, and they're riding on horses and their ships are massive? What did they think of those people coming over from Europe? They thought they were gods. But, I mean, oh, it didn't take them long to figure it out, right? But they definitely had a very limited perspective on the world, and they thought, oh, these people are amazing. Imagine if America hadn't been discovered until today, and instead of Columbus shows up in a boat, he shows up in one of these. And the Indians are running around naked on the islands in the Bahamas, and this thing flies overhead. What do they think it is? Yeah, it's not a monster. It's a god. It's much more than a monster. I mean, it's something that they literally cannot conceive of. They would have to ascribe that to a supernatural agency. They would have no reference whatsoever to make sense of that. They would say that is a god. So, you know, it's this fascinating world we live in where we have this notion of the supernatural and of gods, and yet, for most of human beings who would ever in their existence conceive of what, try to look at what we're doing in the present right now, and that's all they would see is gods. Human beings sleep while they fly? Are you kidding me? They fly. Human beings fly. Human beings have walked on the moon. And before your life is over, people will be walking on Mars. What was Mars to the Romans? literally. What was Mars to the Romans? Does anybody know? Alexander?
The god of war?
It was a god! It was a god! Now, we know, because of science and technology, it's a planet! And we can go there! We can build a rocket, get in, and go there! So, oh my gosh, this modern world of ours is staggering! It's so completely different than everything that's existed before! We've gone through some kind of transformation. That transformation is called the Renaissance, in essence. Because what it involves is a transformation in the way that people look at the world. In the Dark Ages, absolutely everything is centered around Christianity and interpreting the world through a religious lens. Everything. Right? We've seen that Europe didn't quite have a center in the sense that the popes and the emperors and the kings were always arguing about who was in charge. But everything had to do with Christianity. That was the meaning of everything. And then Greek and Roman civilization is reborn and it changes. All of a sudden, Jesus is not a tiny god teaching. He's a child. And a whole different outlook starts to combine with Christianity and produce a civilization that is a strange combination. And we live in it. We live in a very strange time. Right? Because what is Christianity today? What is Christmas today, which upsets a lot of people, right? I mean, the more seriously religious somebody is, the more upsetting something like this is. The more upsetting something like American Christmas is with Coca-Cola and Big Happy Santa Claus, right? It's kind of a strange thing. What does this have to do with this? A lot of people definitely struggle with this question, don't they? What does it have to do? People wonder, because we live in this very different civilization. That's a combination. So, regardless of whether or not you like Coca-Cola, which doesn't matter, I mean, part of it is, you know, it's more the symbol of Santa. And it's more the symbol of modern affluence and modern industrial capitalism and so on, is what this is, right? And yet, in modern society, we still have the Christ in Christmas, right? It's a strange, unstable kind of combination. You have electrical lighting displays of the nativity scene on people's lawns. So we live in a time where Christianity has been radically transformed, not at all like the Christianity that Columbus knew. Not at all like the Christianity that Columbus knew. One of the transformations is called the Renaissance, and the other transformation is called the Reformation. Last thing for today. And here's Martin Luther, some of you may recognize that name, basically setting things in motion. Martin Luther is going to radically transform Christianity, and others like him are as well. It's going to be a completely different thing when he's done with it. So we're going to end up in this new world. We're going to end up here. We're going to end up here. We're going to end up here. This is nothing like Columbus's world. It's so completely different. So that's our theme. The shaping of a new world, the one that we live in. We don't live in Columbus's world. I mean, we live in the results of his actions. We live in the results of his discovery and the other discoveries during the Age of Discovery. We live in a world that's the result of a rebirth of ancient learning and of an ancient way of life that the Greeks and the Romans have embraced, and we live in a time where Christianity has been radically transformed because of a Reformation and religious wars. That's the next phase of our studies. We're getting closer to us, our world. It's complex. It's strange. It's marvelous. It's all of those things. So we're working our way there. All right. Well, hopefully you have some eagerness to proceed. Tomorrow, back to history through art, and we'll get this show on the road. Thanks, everybody. I'll talk to you tomorrow. Bye for now.
Bye, Mr. Poe.
Bye-bye.
Bye, Mr.